Thank you, Thomas, and thanks for the invitation. It's a wonderful occasion to meet again after the Berlin meeting in, I think, 2011 or 2012 with several of you. Ladies and gentlemen, whenever I open the latest issue of Ethos, the flagship journal of the Society for Psychological Anthropology, it contains several fascinating articles that I would like to discuss with my colleagues. Unfortunately, none of them is interested in psychological anthropology, and as I was really interested in what Thomas had to say about my working group on psychological anthropology. Maybe afterwards you can pass me the emails of my colleagues who are interested in that, because I haven't found them yet. So what I used to do when I had my print copy of Ethos, I turned to my wife, who's a colonial historian. I stopped doing this when I realized that her reception vacillated between enthusiasm and tedium. Fortunately, I found two new victims, two professors of psychology. One of them specialized in cross-cultural variations of PTSD, and the other in parenting and antisocial behavior. I copied the articles of Ethos that might be of interest to them and eagerly awaited our discussion over a cup of coffee. They were generous interlocutors, but I always sensed some puzzlement in their reactions. Yet somehow I seem to have raised their interest because when they retired some years ago, each of them invited me to give a presentation at their farewell symposia in the university's auditorium to an audience of hundreds of psychologists, and I assume I was there for the cross-cultural touch. The reactions at the reception were always kind, and some even remarked that more anthropologists should make an effort to share their cross-cultural knowledge with psychology. Really? As if anthropologists had not tried to do so many times before. Didn't Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict try? Didn't Gregory Bateson, Geoffrey Gore, Mel Spiro, Vincent Carpenzano, and Nancy Shepherd Hughes try? Their insights were only received when they would fit the psychological concepts, models, and theories already in place. So here's the question, where to go from here? I think that we should stay where we are, but that now and then we should make forays into the field of psychology on their terms. We should definitely continue to, as it says in the roundtable's background text, I quote, illuminate historically and socio-culturally situated concepts of self, personhood, and what it means to be human, end of quote. But we should also proactively reach out to psychology by adopting some of their discourse and doing some anthropological proselytizing. In this way, we can engage in an interdisciplinary discussion of on psychology's own turf. Of course, as you can imagine, I wouldn't make this suggestion without having tried it myself. A number of years ago, I was trying to understand why the national mourning of the dead and disappeared in Chile and Argentina was so different. Comparisons are always tricky in anthropology because of our ethnographic approach to local realities and our tendency to emphasize the complexity of social worlds and practices rather than to look for ways to simplify matters by separating the chaff from the wheat, as is common in psychology. Nevertheless, Chile and Argentina had both experienced guerrilla insurgencies and military dictatorships that disappeared and assassinated tens of thousands of people. And when the dictatorships fell from power, the two countries had truth commissions, amnesty laws, and reparation measures. So these similarities convinced me that I could pull off a comparison between the two countries about national mourning. Now, if the two countries had comparable pasts, then what could explain the fact that Argentina had a noted emphasis on remembrance and retributive justice, while in Chile there was an emphasis on reconciliation and restorative justice? To complicate matters even further, there were also periods, shorter periods in Argentina, when there were amnesties and policies directed at social peace. While in Chile, on the contrary, there were periods in which perpetrators were brought to trial for their crimes against humanity. And it took me quite some time to write up the many aspects of the comparison, but once done, I still couldn't make sense of it. And it was difficult writing up the comparison because you only get generally like 6,000-7,000 words to do this. So I went to the anthropology of death literature, but it only made me more uncertain about the validity of my comparison to start with. As an American anthropologist and close friend of mine told me, "Tony, it simply can't be done." I was about to give up when, in my periodic browsing of psychology journals, I ran into a model of mourning that seemed promising, namely the dual process model of coping with bereavement. And this model hypothesizes that bereaved persons do not only search for the meaning of their losses, but also try to make sense of their shattered lives through an oscillation between loss-oriented, on the dead loved one, and restoration-oriented coping processes. In other words, bereaved people alternate periods in which they are emotionally focused on the lost person with periods in which they try to pick up the pieces and lead a meaningful life without the presence of the deceased loved one. And immediately things fell into place for me. I adapted the model of oscillatory mourning designed for intrapersonal and interpersonal coping processes to the national level, to Argentina and Chile, and stayed clear from its therapeutic implications. Done. I send the manuscript to the mostly psychology journal Death Studies and waited for the reviews, 6 long months. But they finally arrived. And the reviews had been written by 2 psychologists who were very positive about the paper, but it needed, you know, the notorious sentence, major revisions. Okay, here we go. What was the nature of these revisions? Well, they wanted me to significantly expand the theoretical model and reduce the ethnographic data to a few tables. I was very surprised. Basically, they wanted me to get rid of what I personally regarded, and as an anthropologist regarded, as the empirical proof of my analysis, and instead show the, as I said, universalizing tendencies of my anthropological model. Although, as you can imagine, even if you have tenure, you have these moments of disappointment, you're upset, you're reticent, some of the emotional phases I went through. But ultimately, I did what was asked, and the article was subsequently published. I came away from this experience with 3 lessons. First of all, ethnographic data are discipline-specific evidence. They may be interesting tidbits for psychologists, but don't have any general epistemic value. If we want to enter into a conversation with psychologists, then we should let go of our overemphasis on ethnography. Secondly, we should be just as picky as psychologists and adopt only those psychological concepts, models, and theories that are suitable for our anthropological purposes and needs. And finally, we should engage in serious self-critique and ask ourselves why other disciplines listen so seldom to anthropologists. We should rethink, I think, our knee-jerk rejection of cross-cultural comparison and generalization, and search for ways to satisfy our need for local ethnographic detail, while trying to fit those details into a larger model that will be inviting for psychologists. Thank you.